Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
You know, the massacre, the tragedy of 7/10, we can't forget it or forgive it. But the enemy now of the Israeli people is our government.
Israeli protesters want peace and a new prime minister. It's Wednesday, April 3rd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later on the show, one critic's take on Cowboy Carter. Also, we'll speak with the CEO of Hasbro on how he's trying to steer the company away from toys and more towards games.
People are playing at older and older ages. You know, they're playing well into adulthood, but they're shifting to more games at early and earlier ages.
That's coming up in a few minutes. But first, all week, there have been nightly protests in Jerusalem against the Israeli government and its war in Gaza. Last night, a number of protesters clashed with police outside the home of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Thousands have camped out across from the Israeli parliament. They're calling for elections and for Netanyahu to step down. And we wanted to hear from one of them. Guy Hirschfeld is a longtime peace activist in Israel. He's been active in this week's demonstrations. And here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
So last night outside the prime minister's private residence, I've seen footage of demonstrators with torches, raised fists, and Israeli flags. And one article quotes people saying this was an unplanned detour to the home. Was this planned or no?
I don't think this was a detour. This was the target, all the time the target. There was no plan to go inside like they're trying to draw it. I think it was the plan to go to the prime minister house and also to the president house. And like you said, it was the final event after three nights in front of the Knesset.
Reportedly, police used water cannons against demonstrators, a water that some call skunk water. What sparked the violence and the police response?
I was hit by this skunk water cannon. And it was in the end of the event. And because one of the protesters crawled down the water tank and actually didn't let her go, after it, it was only revenge. There was no need to work with this water cannon. But it was revenge against the protesters that done what they done under the water skunk. I'm sorry because I lost also my voice. But we walked all over Jerusalem and it was completely different. The prime minister residence was completely blocked. And few hundred meters from there, the president house, like, was nothing. No police, just the regular guarding. So they just protected the Bibi, the dictator, and there was no plan to do something, to go inside, just a non-violent protest.
Yeah, Bibi, of course, a reference to the prime minister. Now, the protesters been calling for new elections, for a new government, and for the hostages to come back. And the question is, would a new government really have a better chance of bringing the hostages back if, say, Hamas is resolute? It may not matter.
I think even your president said, and we feel it here in Israel more, that the only block between releasing the hostages and not is our prime minister, that doing everything to prevent it and doing everything to make the war keep going. for his personal benefits. So I really hope and I really think that with another prime minister, it will be different.
As far as personal benefit, that prime minister, if he continues this war, can put off his own corruption trial in Israel, yeah?
Yeah. His situation is really bad, and you know that if it will be quiet in Israel, Palestine, and in the area, is finished. So his mission is to keep it going. It's the war, it's everything. The war, the occupation, and not bringing back the hostage.
Now, I'd read that one rabbi on the scene at the protest is quoted as saying, protesters, his words, forget that the real enemy is Hamas, whose actions set off this war, not Netanyahu. What's your response?
For me, you know, the massacre, the tragedy of 7/10, we can't forget it or forgive it. But the enemy now of the Israeli people is our government. Because you can see it, especially in the U.S., from the U.S., that there is plans for the day after. There is plan to ceasefire. There is a suggestion to bring back the hostages, and everything is stuck because of our prime minister. And this is the reality of the Israeli people today. And there is no way to beat Hamas just in a military way. So you need to think about the day after, and our government is don't want to do it.
Guy, what is next? Are the protests going to continue into tonight and tomorrow?
Today and tomorrow we are taking time off the big protest. There will be small protests all over all the time. The big protest will come back on Saturday in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And we need to remember that in these critical times, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, today took time off and went for vacation for a month and a half or 2 months. So it will be different, but we shall continue to protest until we shall get rid of this government.
We've been talking to Guy Hirschfeld, who has been active in the demonstrations in Israel. Guy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we sit down with the head of one of the world's biggest game companies. You might know Hasbro for classic toys and action figures like G.I. Joe or Transformers, or maybe board games like Monopoly. It's also celebrating 50 years of Dungeons & Dragons. And while the role-playing game has had enormous success in recent years, many fans have grown disenchanted with the conglomerate that owns it. Scott is our Dungeon Master after the break.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Dungeons & Dragons turns 50 this year, and the company that owns it, Hasbro, plans to make it even bigger. Now, for those of us of a certain vintage, we know Hasbro through toys like Mr. Potato Head, Candyland, that board game, and me personally, the Raggedy Andy doll many, many, many years ago. But Hasbro also makes Transformers, Nerf, My Little Pony, and it is pivoting now to focus on digital money makers like the D&D video game adaptation Baldur's Gate 3.
The future of Baldur's Gate hangs in the balance. Will you be the hero and save it from looming darkness? Or will the city crumble under your influence?
And Hasbro's recent phone-based game, Monopoly Go, also made a whopping $2 billion. We're joined now by Hasbro's CEO, Chris Cox, to talk about the future. Chris, welcome to Here and Now.
Scott, hey, thanks for having me.
Many of us have heard of Dungeons & Dragons, but don't play it. So for the rest of us, do you have a quick anecdote to help us understand why it has endured for 50 years now?
Well, I think it's really the power of the human imagination and the timeless urge to tell stories around a campfire. In this case, our campfire is a table. D&D connects these two very powerful kind of human needs and human drives in a really fun, loose set of rules that allows you to be silly with your friends and family.
Yeah, yeah. And are you a player? I mean, do you identify with this, you know, this connection yourself?
Oh, yeah. D&D was founded in 1974, and I was founded in 1973. I started playing in 1983 and have been playing, most of my life.
Yeah. Well, there is a digital game version of D&D, Baldur's Gate 3. We just heard a little audio of that. It was a huge hit last year. And yet last year, right around Christmas, Hasbro, the company, laid off about one-fifth of its workers, about 1,000 jobs, including some employees who make Dungeons & Dragons. Why did the company choose to do that?
Well, we've been going through a turnaround for the last couple of years, particularly in our toy business, you know, making these tough trade-offs around how we preserve our cost base, drive our growth, and think about where we want to go in the future of the company. They're always hard, especially when they affect people we work with, who are friends and colleagues and loyal to the company. You know, we had to make the tough decision to let some people go at the end of last year. That overwhelmingly affected our toy business and kind of like the corporate services that helped support it. It did have a smaller impact on our games business, but that was for, you know, different reasons. Mm-hmm. And we think it's going to be a major grower for us in the future.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned toys. For those of us who know this company by its toys, companies now 101 years old, I understand. Just big picture, what is it that's more challenging about the toy side that has you appearing to pivot more to the game side and the digital side?
It's more of a kind of an industry thing. Games has been growing at, you know, mid to high single digits for the last decade. Toys has been growing more at like a single digit basis for the last, you know, 10, 20 years. A lot of that has to do with birth rates and kind of like the changing nature of play. You know, increasingly people are playing at older and older ages. You know, they're playing well into adulthood, but they're shifting to more games at earlier and earlier ages, both tabletop as well as digital games. Yeah. And so, you know, from our perspective, we continue to invest significantly behind our toy business. We continue to grow those brands. We had some big hits last year like Furby and Transformers Rise of the Beasts. While we see a bright future for toys, I think we see an even brighter future for our games business, particularly for brands like D&D and Magic the Gathering.
As you know, Mr. Cox, you know, some fans have noticed and been critical of the company decisions. The same year there were these significant layoffs, you yourself got a raise that same year, and I want to play some audio from Vincent Chandler. He's a fan of the product and a YouTuber.
I'm seeing people, good people, losing their jobs whilst a CEO takes home millions and millions of dollars.
What do you say to fans who feel disconnected from the corporation?
It's always hard. You know, we try very, very hard to satisfy our fans, create a big tent for the game. But, you know, when you have large brands, particularly brands that have been around for as long as D&D and Magic have, you're always going to have different pockets of people who want different things from the games, simply because, you know, some people started playing the games in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, and the game changes over time. We try to, you know, drive a big tent. We try to be fair and open-minded about players of all stripes and all backgrounds. But at the end of the day, you know, we ultimately have to make some trade-offs. And usually the trade-off that we make most frequently is around expanding the game and expanding its appeal to new and newer and newer audiences. And sometimes you have fans that are more experienced or have a different way of that they want to play that they'd like you to keep and not change. It's just the nature of dealing with large businesses and large fan bases.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about a little bit more about D&D fans. My brother's one of them, you know, played for four decades or so. A number of fans said they were outraged when a leaked corporate document came out that would have taken from them some royalty money from individual creators who make content of their own for the game, say a new monster or a new world in D&D. Hasbro walked back the plan. For the lifelong fans who are critical, how do you make sure to win them back? These are loyal fans.
Yeah, like I said, we take a very big tent approach to how we manage the brands and how we think about our fandom. I think social media is wonderful. It's a very powerful marketing vehicle for us. It's a great way for us to connect with our fans and connect with influencers. But you also have to take a really broad sampling of players' opinions. If you look at Magic the Gathering, if you look at Dungeons and Dragons, if you look at our board games, more people are playing these games than ever before. Our satisfaction rates, the happiness that players have are higher than ever. You know, it's one of the most open game licenses in the history of gaming. It's got a vibrant creator community that we value a great deal. We continue to work with those creators. We continue to work with those small publishers. We continue to work with those streamers to make the game as big as possible and as great of a hobby as well as a living for people who kind of create around it as we possibly can.
Hmm. Now, Hasbro has another pillar tentpole product, hugely popular, the popular card game Magic the Gathering. It's Hasbro's first billion-dollar brand. And the company's seeking to steer it toward more casual players by printing and putting out more cards for people to play. But Bank of America recently downgraded company stock in response, saying Hasbro was, quote, killing the golden goose, flooding the market. Is that a potential trade-off here? You want to reach more people, but if you have too much product out there, then each card becomes less valuable?
Well, I think it's also important to say a couple months after Bank of America gave us that rating, they actually raised us back up to a buy. So, you know, things change a little bit.
Okay.
You know, we've tripled the size of the game. We significantly expanded the overall player base. And we've done that by thinking expansively about who plays it or who could play it. You know, most video games, particularly most kind of more hardcore strategy games, they have maybe 10 or 15% of their player base that identify as non-male. For Magic, you know, it's more like 35% of players identify as non-male. For Dungeons and Dragons, it's closer to 45%. Mm. You know, we're very proud of the diversity and the focus on all players of all different stripes. You know, our hobby stores, who are the primary people who sell the game, there's about 10,000 of them around the world who sell it. They've never been more successful than with that. And those are small and medium-sized businesses that, you know, usually are doing $200,000 or $300,000 of business a year. And, you know, our larger vendors have also done really well. Like, we've grown across the board and grown both players as well as their engagement in it.
Chris, you have said you want Hasbro to be not a toy and game company, but a game and toy company that is games first. You recently announced a $1 billion company investment into digital games. Hasbro also has a video game coming out starring none other than Matthew McConaughey. This after the Dungeons and Dragons movie did okay. But is this where you're headed? Not so much Hollywood movies, but blockbuster games?
Well, I think it's all of the above. We continue to invest in entertainment. We have a pretty significant team there. And we have some great Hollywood movies and TV shows in development or already produced. you know, Transformers 1 will be a major animated theatrical event later this year, looking at the origin story of Optimus Prime and Megatron, for instance. Peppa Pig is one of the top-rated TV shows and streaming shows for kids under the age of 6 or 7. But video games are obviously a huge form of entertainment. I think more and more they're dominating younger viewers and younger players' favorite brands. I think you see the success of video games with things like the Super Mario movie last year, or how, you know, games are starting to transcend and drive, you know, multi-generational play. So certainly we see that, and we're investing accordingly. We continue to invest behind entertainment. We are investing more and more in digital. And then we've got our great kind of physical-based play portfolio of iconic games and toys.
And finally, sir, kind of speaking of generations, for people like me who associate Hasbro, the company, with toys from past generations, is the reality, and this company's been around and it has changed its business model many times in the 101 years, is the reality that a company like Hasbro just needs to keep evolving? And if that means a little bit less emphasis on toys and more on digital products where the revenue seems to be, that's the nature of how it works?
Well, I think most companies that are around for 100 years and have the kind of stable brands that Hasbro has, it's not an accident. You know, I think three real principles guide us. First and foremost, it's about knowing what your center is, what's your core. And our core is play and delighting people and creating communities based on play. I think the second thing for us is not being afraid of new technologies and new trends and trying things, trying them responsibly, but, you know, digging in and figuring out how we can evolve what the state of the art of play looks like. And then last but not least, I think a major strength of a company like ours that kind of drives our durability and will drive our future is being diversified. So, you know, we're a toy and game company. We've got, you know, one of the best game portfolios in the world, but we also have an iconic portfolio of toy-based brands as well. Hmm. And I think when you talk to Hasbro CEO on our second 100th anniversary, you know, 99 years from now, I think they'll be talking about how we're still in toys and how we're still in games. And how we're talking about the next generation of exciting technologies or play patterns that we can be innovating on. That's certainly what we're trying to build for now. And I'm confident we'll be building for it in the future as well.
That is Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro. Mr. Cox, thanks so much for the time.
Scott, thanks so much.
Coming up, saddle up, partner. Beyoncé says Cowboy Carter isn't a country record, it's a Beyoncé record. But it does have a lot to say about country music and Americana. DJ Deepa Fernandez has more after the break.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them, and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
it's Cowboy Carter time. We're talking, of course, about the latest Beyoncé album. Beyoncé wrote on Instagram that Cowboy Carter was, quote, born out of an experience that I had years ago when I did not feel welcomed. That experience is widely speculated to be the racist backlash to her 2016 performance at the Country Music Awards with the Chicks. With his gun, with his head held high, he's told me not to cry. Oh, my daddy said you. Oh, my daddy said you. Now that we've had a few days to digest Cowboy Carter, let's talk about the response to this album with Mankapur Conte, a music journalist for Rolling Stone. Mankapur, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Deepa. Thanks for having me.
So, as you know, there have been really joyous and cowboy-themed dance parties all over the place since this album dropped Friday. So, Mankapur, now that people have had time to really hear the album, how are fans and critics rating Cowboy Carter?
The reviews that I've seen have been widely positive. It was a bit unexpected. I think when we started to hear and get, you know, when she released the singles 16 Carriages and Texas Hold'em, it felt pretty surprising. But I think, like, it's particularly in my circle of friends in media, we've been, like, really refreshed by her takes on country, on roots music, on R&B blues, and all these other genres that she's put together.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a classic country album, but Beyoncé herself even said before the record came out that it wouldn't be a country album, it would be a Beyoncé album. I wonder if you can talk about how that showed up.
I think that being able to frame the album that way freed her from it being judged or critiqued or even thought about solely along the lines of country standards or tropes. So you can hear throughout the album, she raps several times. Mm-hmm. There's hip hop, there's R&B influence. But I think that she also, you know, prioritized leaning into instruments like banjos and fiddles and steel pedal guitar, sounds that are more associated with Americana, folk, rock and roll, and country music.
So let's talk a bit about the covers on this album. Cowboy Carter includes Beyoncé's take on Jolene by Dolly Parton. There are some lyric changes here, so everyone listen carefully. Jolene, 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 Jolene. Don't take the chance because you think you can. You're beautiful beyond compare. Takes more than beauty and seductive stares to come between a family and a happy man. Tell us more about this. I understand Stevie Wonder played harmonica on it.
Yeah, Jolene to me is one of the most fascinating songs on the album because I think that it's a feat in storytelling, and storytelling in like a very literary sense, I think is so important to how we think about country music in particular, because in Dolly Parton's original Jolene, she's pleading to this woman to not seduce and steal her man, right? She's like, I'm going to be lost without him, and I know you have the power to do this, so please have mercy on me. And Beyoncé is not looking for mercy on her version of Jolene. Beyoncé is more so issuing a warning. And so the lyrics are flipped quite intensely. You know, she's telling this Jolene character who might be, you know, having her sights set on her partner that she's going to be in for a world of trouble if she tries, and that Beyoncé can see through her. And that also she's in a relationship that is so strong, that has been tried and tested by time and strife, that her partner is not going to waver anyway. So it feels like it's like a Lemonade throwback, but it also is just like a really, really interesting feat of storytelling as well.
Mm. Let's talk a little more about collaborators. You wrote about Shaboozey, who shows up on a few tracks on Cowboy Carter. Here he is on Spaghetti. Hey, out to the moon. Out to the moon. Out to the moon. Outlaws women, they gonna show. Keep the car, break the rules. We gonna ride for every member that we lose. Someone here brought five. Ain't no telling who. What does he bring to this album?
Yeah, I think that one of the things Shaboozey represents about Beyoncé's approach to this album is reaching into contemporary Black artists that are making and like messing with country. And so Shaboozey, you know, he released his first album in 2018. And he, I think, is really interesting because he has been making a blend of country, rock, hip-hop, Americana. And he, I think his story is really interesting in the layout of these genres because he's Nigerian-American. His parents are Nigerian. And he was raised in Northern Virginia, which is like more, the culture I think is more thought of as more closely to D.C. than the South, or like our ideas or conceptions of the South. So I think it's really interesting in bringing together, you know, this idea of like America, American music, and all these different identities that he holds while he's choosing to make music that is largely like situated in country. And I think another thing that's interesting about him is in an interview, you know, someone asked him, like, have you ever felt tension or have you ever felt unwelcomed in the country music community? And he was like, never. Whereas the genesis, right, of this album that, you know, we're largely speculating is Beyoncé feeling incredibly unwelcome at the Country Music Awards many years ago.
Indeed. And I like the phrase you just used, that Beyoncé is messing with country, because as she does that, she's already scored a number one Billboard country hit with Texas Hold'em. But let's take a step back for a sec, because I want to ask you about a recurring theme in Beyoncé's music, what it means to be American. And we see her on this album posing with the American flag on the cover, asking if we want a new America on the song Ya Ya. How is she thinking about this question?
I hear this idea of Beyoncé refusing to throw out her American identity and allegiances with the country's sins and harms and problems. I think that Beyoncé has always been super interested in legacy. And, you know, for better or for worse, you know, Beyoncé is American through and through, you know, family from Alabama, Louisiana, raised in Texas. She often talks about her children and her work as her legacy, her culture as her legacy. But I also, I think a lot about this idea of double consciousness, you know, a sociological idea originated from W.E.B. Du Bois, where it's like, you know, Black people in America often have to think about ourselves in two ways. We think about the pride and the culture we have in our Black identity, but also how we're treated in the world that we face or the country that we face as Americans. And even like with the two eyes in all throughout the track list, you know, I think of that as probably a reference to this being act two of a trilogy. But I also wonder if Beyoncé is thinking like there are these two parts of me that are deeply in tension.
And talk about the criticism of this album, because it feels like there has been more than Renaissance, that people do have some critiques of this. Have you heard that?
Yeah. One of my favorite writers is Doreen St. Felix, and she writes for The New Yorker. One of her critiques is that Cowboy Carter, maybe to some people, promised a sort of idea of something more revolutionary. Doreen frames it as like burning the barn down, and then comes around and says, you know, she didn't really do that. And I think that also has a lot to do with how I think she thinks about her identity as an American, and also how she has moved throughout the music industry. Beyoncé has, I think, done more to reform the way we think about identity, Americanness, perhaps even the Grammys, than completely usurping it and starting over and building something new. And I think that this album is like deeply, deeply symbolic of that.
Mm. Leave us with one of the songs from the album that you think hasn't gotten enough attention.
Yeah, I love Two Hands to Heaven. It's such a journey. It's so cinematic. It's towards the end, and the album is long. I think one criticism is it's very long. It takes a lot of steam to get through. But I think that album that song is really spectacular. So I'm enjoying listening to it and the little parts of it that I catch each time.
My feet on the dashboard, and I go really fast, boy. Ever since I went to my fire, ain't no trouble on my mind. Singing sweet songs to Las Vegas, singing I will carry on.
We've been talking with Mankapur Conte. She's a music journalist for Rolling Stone. Thank you so much, and we will listen as we go out.
Singing, I will carry on. 10,000 steps towards the time of your life. Two hands to heaven, my whiskey.
My favorite track, Two Most Wanted, probably. Maybe Bodyguard. Anyway, that's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Shirley Jihad, James Mastromarino, and Gabrielle Healy. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Caleb Green and Mike Moschetto. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.